Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They are all over Facebook and Twitter, at the bottom of a million emails, maybe yours, quotations from the famous and infamous, from Shakespeare to Yogi Berra, Marie Antoinette to George W. Bush. They're part of our language and culture, a kind of currency of catchy thought and nifty phrasing, sometimes a philosophy of life. This hour on Point, the secret life of quotations, how they work, how they shape our thinking and our world. You can join the conversation. Who do you quote? What do you quote? And why? What's the power in the great quotation? Also, you should really check out the outpouring of quotations our listeners are sharing on our Facebook page, On Point Radio, and at our website, onpointradio.org, and add yours. We'll see if we can get it on the air. Joining me now from Chicago is Gary Saul Morrison, professor of arts and humanities at Northwestern University. He's professor of Slavic languages and literature, also author of Anna Karenina, In Our Time. His new book is The Words of Others, From Quotations to Culture. Gary Saul Morrison, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us today from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own eminently quotable news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, thanks very much for dropping by.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Morrison.
Hi.
So it's great to have you all with us. And there is an avalanche of favorite quotes coming in right now all over Facebook and our website. Clearly, there is enormous enthusiasm for what you're delving into here. Gary Saul Morrison, what is it about quotations, the great and the not so great? What is the, what looks like an unending appeal, Ralph Waldo Emerson aside?
I've always found them appealing myself. I browse through quotation anthologies. And so I asked that question, why do people like this so much? If you go on the web just to look at Amazon, to look up quotation books, they're just endless. Thousands are in print at any given time. I think it's partly that we make a self and we make a culture out of the words of others. That is, we develop by learning what our parents have said, what our teachers say, and we repeat them. And gradually they become ourselves. Ourself is the quotations we have learned and made so much our own we don't recognize them as our own. And the same thing happens with language. I mean, we no longer put quotation marks around a lot of, let's say, foreign words or neologisms that somebody coined, because we don't even feel their quotations anymore. Like a word like sociology, which, you know, somebody had to coin, It's just part of our language. You could almost say that language is former quotations. And we all sense this. This is how it's our mental food. We assimilate it. We become it. And so it becomes endlessly fascinating to us. Also, you can collect them fairly easily. I mean, it's fairly expensive to collect artwork, but you can collect quotations, and you can have a museum of them in your pocket, you know, just an anthology.
And many, many do. So, Jack Beattie, what about it? Whether we actively collect them or just hear them and are sort of padded together from the, you know, the clay of that language by them, are we all just a jumble of quotes and quips we've picked up like barnacles on a boat?
It can seem that way sometimes when they just present themselves inevitably to the mind, and you can feel sort of inauthentic at such moments, or your interlocutor can feel that way to you. There's a scene in, I think, The Possessed, if I'm not mistaken, Professor Morrison can correct me, where a Dostoevsky novel where one character is giving quotations and flowery language to another, and the other character says, "You're not a friend, you're a stylist." and you can feel that. You can feel that sometimes with the person given to quotes, and I say that as one who is given to them.
Of course, I mean, that danger of pump
pomposity is always there, and we can quote those who have cited it. You have Gary Solmorsen, Rudyard Kipling, talking about someone who says, he wrapped himself in quotations as a beggar would enfold himself in the purple of emperors, Gary.
Yes, and Orwell once wrote that about an author he was reviewing, that he was as unable to resist a quotation as a drink. you know, and we have that feeling. We just want to quote, you know, and after a while, we realize how it's going to sound. And, you know, we don't want to sound like all those people we laugh at for not having words of their own.
Can you make some distinctions for us here? Make them between quotations, maxims, platitudes. What's the Venn diagram look like if we think of these?
Well, it's hard to say because none of these words have any, you know, fixed definitions that everybody agrees with. But I would use the term quotation as, you know, the general term for all the different kinds of things that we might quote, whether they're maxims, which are little words of wisdoms, or aphorisms, which tend to be pithy, sharp comments about human nature, or proverbs, which... well, they're like maxims, but they pretty much have to be anonymous, and they're supposedly the wisdom of the people. You could call all of these quotations. Some people call them all aphorisms. There isn't any fixed definition, and if you don't want to be too pedantic, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference unless you are correcting somebody else, in which case you better have a definition, and then you'll usually quote somebody else's definition. We're back where we started.
Jack, they're pouring in on our website. Jeff offers a lot here, you know, the kind that really stand out. We know them over time. There are so many of these, but facts are stubborn things. Not Ronald Reagan here, but John Adams. A horse, my kingdom for a horse. Mm-hmm. How many times people have said that, you know, waiting for the bus or for somebody to come with the car? Quoting Tom Waits, there ain't no devil, only God when he's drunk. Quoting Bugs Bunny, what's up, Doc? Okay. And here's Lynn quoting Wayne Gretzky, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. The kind of inspirational vein of quotation, Jack.
Oh, those are just wonderful. Those are just wonderful. And those are the happy ones, you know. But I don't mean to emphasize the negative, but it can be awkward knowing too many of them. For example, knowing what Hobbes said of sexual intercourse, quote, the pleasure is brief, the expense is exorbitant, and the posture is ridiculous.
You wish you'd never heard it?
Yes, it can get you in trouble if you say that aloud at the wrong time.
I suppose posture takes us into tough territory. We've got a listener, Richard, who loves Mae West, speaking of human sexuality. Here's a few from Mae West. A man in the house is worth two in the street. Give a man a free hand and he'll run it all over you. I only like two kinds of men, domestic and foreign. And finally from Mae West, I used to be Snow White, but I drifted. Gary Solmorsen, there's inspiration to be the best we can be, in quotation. And there's also all kinds of humor, including right down and dirty with a nice twist on it.
Oh, yes. I mean, and the ones that are, you know, have a double entendre or directly obscene, the ones we particularly like. Another type I particularly like are the type that we quote because they sound particularly stupid. I like to call these not witticisms, but witlessisms. And, you know, some of them are just plain dumb, like the ones, you know, we attribute to Dan
Quayle. Let's hear it. Okay, what's that?
Oh, you know, like in Latin, they speak Latin in Latin America, those sort of, you know, comments like that.
All right.
But some of the dumb ones are actually... a particular type we love are ones that are dumb at first hearing, but actually when you think about them, they're not so dumb. Yogi Berra, of course, is the master of these. You know, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I when I'm hesitating, you know, I can't make a decision. I sometimes think about that because, you know, what it can mean is, well, make some decision. Any decision is better than none in a case like that.
You can call it dumb, but it's got the brilliance of a Zen cone there, the
That's
kind of
right.
dilemma buried in it that illuminates.
That's right. And, you know, some of the ones that sound... Mark Twain specialized, you know, in these two, you know, although he did them deliberately, unlike Mark Twain, unlike Yogi Berra. You know, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it.
Let's bring our listeners right in here on quotes, quotations, maybe even Mark Twain. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Mark.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. What do you have for us?
Well, yeah, great quotations are great because they're electrifying. They just instantly communicate a complicated idea in a way that you can immediately grasp. And Mark Twain, of course, summarized it brilliantly when he said that the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I love that one, Mark. And thank you, Mark. And I'm not ashamed to say, you know, I never had it before, but in the internet era, every day on the page that greets me on when I, you know, log in on the web, there's a little collection offered by one of these apps of quotes of the day, and I snag them as I like them. And Mark, yours is on my list. Lightning and lightning bug on the right word. There's all kind. I'm still Louis Benuel. I'm still an atheist. Thank God. Kind of, that nice twist in it. Or, you know, I mean, Goethe, there's nothing worse than aggressive stupidity. That one occurs to one with some frequency these days. Jack, a lot of people, I know from the outpouring on our website, I'm not the only one who has a little necklace of these I carry around, I guess.
No, and this book is going to give people more of them. I mean, especially in the last words department, Lord Palmerston, last words, "Die, my dear doctor, that's the last thing I shall do."
Yes, last words, gone.
Yes, and Thoreau's last words, "Urge to make his peace with God." I did not know that we had ever quarreled. Who cares whether he said it? It belongs in the wisdom of the ages. And I think that's a good point you make, Professor, that accuracy is not the point about these things. And Googleism is not the point. It isn't to get it, to match it up against the text. They have a life of their own. And they are quotes. They exist apart almost from the real situation.
Let us come back and look at that issue of accuracy. People quoting from all levels here. You've got one there, last words quoting from God. I've got one here on the website, Jack. Steve quoting from Ty Webb in Caddyshack. Be the ball. Okay. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about great quotations, what makes them and how they shape our language and our view of the world. Gary Saul Morrison joins us from Chicago, professor at Northwestern University of Arts and Humanities there, author of Anna Karenina in Our Time, and the new book, The Words of Others, From Quotations to Culture. Our own Jack Beatty is here as well, eminently quotable, and lots of callers. Gary, Jack, let me go to a couple. Tony in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm usually afraid to admit it, but I am a defense attorney, and on my personal email, I quote Mark Twain.
Yes.
If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything.
You remembered that.
You remember that. What do your clients think about that one, Tony?
I don't use that on my business email because I don't, quite frankly, I don't know if any of them know how to tell the truth. But I remind my family and friends that it's still very important to me.
Well, now, it's funny because as wonderful. A defense attorney, it's good words to live by. But it also, in a way, can you hide behind that? I mean, have you never had to shade anything as a defense attorney to do your duty by your client? Can you kind of protect your reputation there behind a quotation?
No. And my reputation I try to build is that I will be brutally honest with you. You may not like what I have to say, and you don't have to agree with what I say, but I will always tell you the truth because if I don't, it won't do either of us any good. And I've had some clients' mothers actually hate me for that, but my clients seem to appreciate it.
Tony, it sounds like you're arm in arm with Mark Twain there, and it sounds like it's done you good. Thanks for that. Lee in Esmont, Virginia. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to say how thrilled I am with your show because since I'm 66, since I was 18, I have been making notebooks full of quotes. I've probably got 100 of them. And I write a lot of letters, and when I'm writing, I pull open one of my books and get a quote. I love quotes.
So what have you used the most? What's got real currency out of your book collection of quotes, Lee?
Oh, at anything. The last thing that I came across was something on Judge Judy when some guy said, "Both sides of the bed were the wrong side, and they were always waking up."
It doesn't have to be Plato or Sophocles. And you roll them right out wherever you find them. Lee, I appreciate that. Let me get one more. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hi. I had more of a question. What are some of the most famous misquotations, what are the dangers, what were the consequences, and when did misquotations actually work to somebody's advantage? Of course, we wouldn't find out until later that it was a misquote, but I'm going to hang up and listen to the answer. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Okay, Mike. Gary, that's right in your wheelhouse. Let's think of talk about misquotation for a moment here. Take us in there, Gary.
Well, it's not as simple a concept as it might seem, because quotations live a life of their own apart from the text they're taken from. Take a phrase that we all quote, like, turn the other cheek. If you were going to be a literalist, the way people who track down misquotations often are, you'd have to say that's a misquotation.
We're misquoting Jesus? I mean, what next?
What the good book says is, if a man strikes thee on one cheek, turn to him also the other. It never says turn the other cheek. So what are you supposed to say? As the good book says, turn to him also the other?
Yeah, but that's just some fancy King James translator there, probably messing with our earthy Mediterranean man.
Well, but we almost always, when you take something out of context and want to make it stand on its own, if there's a pronoun, you better fill in the noun or it makes no sense. Or you better give a context. I mean, a really common one is, that one from Casablanca, play it again, Sam.
Yeah.
Now, what it actually says in the film as you listen to it is, play it, Sam. But that would not get the meaning across, and the context and her tone of voice makes it clear that what she's saying is, play it again, Sam. So if you want to get her tone of voice, which is, after all, part of what she's saying, but
right,
you're not quoting the tone of voice, you have to fill in what the tone of voice conveys. Now, is that a misquotation? Well, in anthologies of misquotations, it's almost always listed that way, but I don't think so, because we quote in order to get a meaning across, and since the quotation has to stand on its own, we have to adjust it sometimes. And then those adjustments take on a life of their own. A really common one that these anthologies often cite is, in his famous speech to the House of Commons, Winston Churchill didn't say, I have nothing to offer but blood, sweat, and tears. He said, blood and toil, sweat and tears. But everybody immediately started quoting blood, sweat, and tears for the obvious reason that it's a lot better. I mean, blood, sweat, and tears are all bodily fluids, and toil isn't. And toil is redundant of sweat. And the fact is that Churchill loved that so much, he started quoting the misquotation.
In fact, it's fine by him.
He entitled a book, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So to find this in anthologies of misquotations, it can't be a misquotation unless what you actually are saying is, on this particular day, Churchill said.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's just, a variant, and we allow variants because you'd have to think of quotations as more like oral literature, and we expect, what's the right version of a joke? What's the right version of a proverb? We expect them to vary.
This is great. Let's pause on it. There must be more here, but it takes us into very rich territory, Jack, where the quotation is taken by the mass of people, and maybe it's improved upon. It's more right than correct. To quote the inestimable Jack Beatty, there's a lapidarian, one of your favorites, process here. that we take it, we put it in that tumbler full of, and the stone comes out smoother and more true somehow, even if not the exact words originally said, Jack.
That's right. And, it's like the, I don't know what they call it, but that open source business on the web where, a million minds are better than one. And that's what's happened over the years with these things. They have been turned into the stones, and you can, all the ambiguity has been filed off. And what you get is the gem, and I even like it, Professor, you mentioned that the quotation books of quotations are often spoken of as in that way, books of gems,
treasures.
Mm-hmm. But they're collective treasures. They're not some genius sitting away. It's all of us over time working on what someone said or maybe didn't say, but improving it regardless.
To go back to Mike in Pittsburgh, though, he's onto something here where he wondered if misquoting has had impact. I mean, we all know quotations have power in them. because somehow they grab our mind. It's a meme that's powerful. If you change the quote, you may change the world. You may shift it in a different direction, Gary.
Well, yes, you can, and that is very often very interesting. Like, you know, the quotation attributed to Marie Antoinette, "Let them eat cake." She actually, of course, she never said anything of the sort. But the idea
she didn't. You're kidding me.
No, she didn't.
Say it isn't so.
Say it isn't so. Roll this tape back.
Well, I particularly like it that people sometimes will correct you to say, well, what she really said was, "Let them eat brioche." But in fact, you know, I love it because she didn't say either. You're correcting what she didn't say. And, you know, it was a very common expression at the time. You'll find it in a lot earlier authors as a way of paraphrasing the attitude of the rich to the poor. And so in a sense, it fit Marie Antoinette, but she didn't actually say it. Nevertheless, you know, her role in the image of Marie Antoinette in French history, you know, has been, well, you know, quite considerable.
Rather tall.
We have a lot of, you know, quotations that it's hard to say whether they're misquotations or not, you know, attributed, let's say, to Lenin, which were obviously politically resonant. Like, when we are ready to hang the capitalists, they will sell us the rope.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, you can find the thought in Lenin, you know. He takes about a paragraph to say it. So you can say, well, is it a misquotation? It's the sort of thing he said, but he didn't actually say it in those words. And yet those words have come down and resonated for us. They stand as an attitude that you don't have to be Lenin to have or to expect in others. You know, they're the attitude of, you know, any really cagey, ruthless politician. You know, if I had told you Machiavelli said that, or, you know, Montesquieu or Henry Kissinger, I guess, it would make as much sense. It lives that life for us. So yeah. Is it a misquotation? Well, yes and no.
And still they pour and gush in here online. John, quoting Richard Dawkins, "By all means, let's be open-minded, but not so open-minded that our brains drop out." Pretty good. "Virtue is its own punishment," quoting Bavan here. Quoting Pogo, the famous one, "We've met the enemy and he is us," of course. Joanne in Lake Placid, New York. Joanne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What have you got?
I've got one of the most famous, well, in my world, one of the most quotable singer-songwriters, the late Warren Zevon, was being interviewed by David Letterman, and he knew his diagnosis. He was soon to pass away with cancer. And everybody was all choked up, and Warren Zevon was known for his wit, his black humor, I guess. And his buddy Dave Letterman said, "Well, what have you got to give us? You know, what are you telling us? What can you tell us as you face death?"
Yeah.
And Warren Zevon paused, his dramatic pause, and he said, "Enjoy every sandwich."
Enjoy every. And I suppose you now tag your emails with that, Joanne. Enjoy every sandwich.
Yes, that is my email tag.
How do we know it? Hey, here's one to Warren Zevon. We'll lift a sandwich to Warren, and thanks for that. Jimmy in Columbia, South Carolina. Jimmy, you're on.
Well, I don't know how much of a common quote this is, but I had a mentor for a number of years, and he had a way of summing up situations very succinctly in a kind of a folklorish way. And one that has served me well over the years was, "You don't have to like a man to drink his liquor."
Okay. A thought to live by, and it brings another glass to hand. Jimmy, I appreciate that one. We've got more in that vein online. Newton says, quotes The Godfather, "Leave the gun, take the cannoli." Maybe in that drink line. Sam in New York's quoting the old Daily Show tagline, "When news breaks, we fix it." I mean, very often it's interesting, Gary.
That's a nice one.
Yeah, there's that twist that you can hear in many of these from, you know, Richard Dawkins right on. They sort of a quote that sets you up in one direction, then flips you back in the opposite of meaning for you to dwell on the contradiction there, maybe for humor or insight.
Sure. That's how a lot of witticisms work. We mentioned famous last words before. There's, you know, the one that is attributed to Oscar Wilde. You know, "Either this wallpaper goes or I do."
Were those last words?
Well, you know, they're attributed to him. But, you know, none of these last words can be relied upon. What are you going to do, ask the person if they were his last words? I first became really suspicious of this when I came across what supposedly were, you know, General Custer's last words. We've caught them napping.
Yeah.
Now, you know,
I doubt it somehow over the sweaty back of a horse.
Was there somebody there recording it? Who, and how did it get out? You know,
you're right.
You know, they're
too cool for school a little bit as well, I think. Maybe on the way to that. Lots more online, Fire Channel, and who knows? It's hard to know what's accurate and what's not. Maybe it doesn't matter. Fire Channel quoting Einstein, there are two things that are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the first. Okay, maybe. Another physicist here, Richard Feynman, physics is like sex. Sure, it may give some practical results, but that's not why we do it. And Nathan quoting Lily Tomlin, no matter how cynical you become, it will never be enough to keep up. John in Colchester, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
That's very nice.
Hi, John.
Hi.
One of the things that I've noticed about quotes is people used to, when they would quote literary figures, they would credit the author. But because we don't know who writes TV shows, it's like fictional characters from TV more and more get quoted like they're real. And my particular favorite is Archie Bunker said, faith is when you believe what nobody in their right mind would believe. And I'll take whatever comments you have off the air.
Yeah, it's great. And of course, it's terrific. But then you're quoting Archie Bunker, which means, Gary, you're quoting a screenwriter or a gag writer.
Well, are you? If you know, some of the pedants who write about this will say, I'm sorry, we can't quote Mae West saying, come up and see me sometime. It's her scriptwriter, whom nobody knows. Now, that's absolutely ridiculous, because the entire point, if you said, you know, Sidney Howard said, come up and see me sometime, it would miss the entire point, because it has to be Mae West. First, it has to be a woman saying it, and then it has to be, you know, someone known for sexuality. It is, you know, the actress saying it, and it's the actress, not even in a particular role, but the actress Mae West playing whatever role she's playing. Very often, the person saying the quote is part of the meaning of the quote. You know, lots of people actually have said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself before, you know, Franklin Roosevelt. But the meaning of that quote for us is his. And so his name is part of the quote. And that can be true with, you know, fictional characters or actors and actresses as well. You don't destroy the quote by taking a piece of it away. And the attribution, in some cases, is part of it.
Jack, does it matter to you if it's some great quoted literally on their deathbed or at the pulpit or at the dais, or if it's a scriptwriter who just came up with a great line, put it in the mouth of Archie Bunker?
As a writer, I should say I want the writer to get the credit, but the persona, it was written for that person. It is that actor, that character's line, just stamped, you might say, Tom, lapidarily. But you know, Mike,
you love that word.
I do. Mike from it sticks in the mind. Mike from Pittsburgh asked the question: can you think of quotations, misquotations that had some significance? I think of a minor example. Bill Clinton was wont to say, and he would say it again and again, he would say, Tocqueville said, Americans are a great people because they are a good people. Well, Tocqueville scholars looked and looked and looked, and they couldn't find that. Now, that wasn't pernicious. That wasn't wrong. But, you know, it's flattering to Americans, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And a foreigner said it.
Yes, of course. So it must be true. Yes. So there's an example, I think, of a misquotation that has a it can flatter the national vanity.
They can be funny. Many people go to them for real serious inspiration. Online here, Kelly quotes Francis Cardinal Spellman, pray as if everything depended on God and work as if everything depended on man. Louisa quotes Cornel West, quoting John Coltrane. She says, to live is to wrestle with despair, but never to allow despair to have the last word. That is the beginning of hope. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great quotations, what makes them and how they shape our language and our view of the world, with Gary Saul Morrison joining us from Chicago, professor at Northwestern University and author of the new book, The Words of Others, From Quotations to Culture. Jack Beatty kindly joins us as well today. Jack, Gary, lots online here from our listeners. Shep quotes Kierkegaard, "Anxiety is the dizziness of freedom." Here's Sean quotes Victor Hugo, "Everything being a constant carnival, there is no carnival left." Rosa goes to your deathbed sayings, Gary. On her deathbed, Gertrude Stein asked, "What is the answer?" Receiving no response, she said, "What is the question?" Now, did she, Gary?
Who would know?
Well, there might have been one. There might have been one in that case who would know.
Well, suppose
somebody who loved her.
Let's suppose she had actually said that, and in just those words, and nobody had cleaned them up, which seems unlikely, but let's just suppose. Yeah. And then afterwards, she said, damn. Or, can I have a drink? Would people say her last words was, can I have a drink? Wouldn't they quote the next to the last words as the last words? And would you really blame them for it?
Well, sure. We clean it up as we go. Here on Twitter, Triangle Man says, another famous false quote, the French don't have a word for entrepreneur. Bush, I assume he means George W. Bush, never said it. Again, Jack, I don't know. There's both there's a quote I never heard and an assertion that the quoted never said it all at once. But it sounds like something maybe W. said.
You're out in you're in outer space with that. There's no firm footing at all. Yeah, and I think that is points to something. There is a political motive in some misquotations. You know, a politician one doesn't like says stupid things, even if the record shows, no, they didn't quite say that. But, you know, you raise a point in here, Gary, about newspaper reporters improving on what their subjects say. They don't quote them exactly. And that's true. They get the grammar right and the false starts and so on. When they do quote them exactly, bad things result. For example, Caroline Kennedy's abortive Senate campaign. Consider that. She had an interview with the New York Times, and they wrote down exactly what she said, which I think had a string of you knows. Every sentence had a you know. And they put it all in there, and that really hurt her. That exact quotation really hurt her. It made people think that she was an airhead, when in fact she was just a woman who spent a lot of time with teenagers.
Well, sure. And if the New York Times had liked her, they would have cleaned it up.
Yes.
You know, that's – but anybody – all of us say stupid things every now and then. If you want to play gotcha with somebody, you can make the smartest person in the world sound, you know, really dumb. And if you – so you have to be suspicious of that, you know, leeway that a press has. Normally – you know, we know that people say you know a lot, and we leave it out. Or
here's a quotation on our website that might have helped out Caroline Kennedy in that case. Chuck writes, "I don't know who this is from. If the fish kept his mouth shut, he wouldn't have got caught." Alan in Montreal, Canada. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have an online bookshop, and we use a Groucho quote on packing slips to get a laugh. It goes like this. Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, my wife.
Of course. Thank you, Alan. Nice. Groucho Marx makes my favorite list, too. With this one, military justice is to justice what military music is to music.
Ooh,
Scott in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I love your show.
Thank you.
And, I love quotes in general, and I kind of keep little books of them or computer files of them. A lot of my favorites come from Frank Herbert's Dune series. Each of his chapters in this book lead off with
the science fiction series. Yeah, like
science
what?
Science fiction, they're great. Well, one of them is, and it's attributed in the book to St. Augustine by one of the characters in the book, but it says, the mind commands the body and the body obeys. The mind commands itself and meets resistance.
Yes.
And, but my absolute favorite one comes from my dad, actually. He was he was about, it was about a year before he died. He had Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And I was visiting with him and having a long conversation. He was asking me what I was up to, and I was explaining to him about meditation. And he was really engrossed in what I was telling him, one of his more lucid moments. And he turned to me and he said, "Well, that's it. Take care of the downtime, and the uptime takes care of itself."
Yeah. Oh, that's very nice.
Quote of all time. Yeah,
oh,
that's been with me ever since.
A little precious truth spoken by Alzheimer's and your dad there, Scott. Thank you very much for that one. We've got a lot more online here. Derek reminds us from Gandhi, you must be the change you wish to see in the world, and that be the change has certainly taken on a life of its own. Emily writes, quoting Galileo, "I've loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night." Buck up, brave up there. And here Roger quoting Lily Tomlin, "I always wanted to be somebody, but I should have been more specific." I'll go with that. Mary in Franklin, Virginia. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, indeed.
I had a wonderful high school English teacher who quoted, and I can't remember who it's attributed to. It was such a wonderful quote. It was, "Foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds."
Oh, yes. And I'm not sure, do you know who that's from, Mary? Any idea?
No, I do not remember. I'm at that age where I can't remember stuff.
Hey, don't worry about it. But thanks for your call. I've heard that, of course. Many times that's been out there. I don't know, Jack, Gary, the internet would have it for us in a flash.
It's Emerson. It's
Emerson.
Emerson.
What I was saying.
So here we are. He must be so chagrined that we're quoting him.
Yeah.
What do we know? Elliot, in calling from New Hampshire. Elliot, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Very well.
I am a high school chemistry teacher, and for the past number of years, every morning I put a new quote up on my board.
Ah.
Don't say anything to the kids. They come in, about half of them write it down, they look at it, the quotes are ridiculous, they are thoughtful, it all varies, and when I forget to put one up, I get chided for not doing it.
Why do you think they pay such attention? I mean, these are students who might think about a lot of other things other than a quote on the board.
I have no idea, but it becomes an integral part of the classroom, and then I do have a couple of quotes that I use throughout the year. The first one is from Aristotle. You are what you repeatedly do. Excellence, therefore, is not an act but a habit. And then I use Sir Arthur Conan Doyle through Sherlock Holmes. When you have eliminated the impossible, that which remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Mm.
And I use that one a lot because I'm going to teach the kids reasoning.
And they pay attention, Elliot. Thanks for sharing that with us. Gary, you've spoken a little about how powerful these quotations are in language, how they work their way into the very fabric and deep in the fabric of language. We come to use them as just almost parts of speech. But there's also this cultural element. And I don't know if it's that they create culture, that they identify and cement it, that they perpetuate it, but they are definitely vessels of culture.
Well, think of it this way. If you met someone who spoke fluent English but had never heard the expression 67 years ago or I have a dream, would you believe that person could possibly be an American? I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. If they didn't know I have a dream.
Mm-hmm. How could an American not know that quotation and be an American? Whereas if you live in England, there are a whole series of quotations they know. If you want to test this out, just try to do a British crossword puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things, you don't have the most basic information, most basic allusions or quotations that they take for granted. It's, and they don't even know they do, and we don't even know they, you know, we do. We just assume it. And,
you know, Jack, that's interesting at so many levels what Gary's sharing there. Take the dream. I mean, from my European friends, it just occurs to me now as he says that, one of the things that they often remark on about Americans is, often in admiring ways, sometimes not, that Americans as a culture are capable of dreaming, that they will run with the dream, that they'll believe in the dream, and through history with that have made great things happen and sometimes big problems. But here's Martin Luther King. He says, "I have a dream. I have a dream." And we all know it. It's central to our culture. but maybe it's also a product of our culture. Maybe it's cementing something at the same time it's lauding it, Jack.
Yes, he was speaking into that vein of culture, that sort of grammar of culture that Americans dream, that they believe in the future, and that's what makes it so memorable. Exactly, it dips down deep into the well of our collective American unconscious and speaks to us in a way that to a foreigner it might sound banal. I have a dream. Well, good. You have a dream. Yeah. I have one. but for King, for that moment, for where he said it at the Lincoln Memorial, and for the being in the United States, in America, it had such significance. But you know, there's also the things we don't know, our ignorances that are idiomatic,
yes,
that are just ours. And you use an example in here, Gary, of a password in World War II, where the password was "recite the second stanza of the Star-Spangled Banner."
Oh my gosh! Nobody's getting through that century.
Only the German spies could do that. You know?
So if you answered that correctly, if you could do it, they shot you.
Right.
Because no American would know
American
that.
No American would ever know that.
Any German spy would be trained to know that. So it's our ignorance. That's the case where a certain kind of ignorance, as you say, Jack, is idiomatic.
You can't really call it a quotation. It's a verse, but it doesn't.
Yeah. Right.
Mason, right. Michigan, Jennifer's calling. Hi, Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to share my favorite quote actually comes from my mother. My father was getting ready to go to work, and he was trying to find something, and he was being a bit of a fuddy-duddy. My mother was trying to help him, and he finally leaves, and she turns to my sisters and I, and she said, "Girls, I want you to remember this. Inside every handsome young prince is an old poop."
An old poop. All right, off you go, Dad. Advice to the young woman. I mean, that's funny, Gary.
That's great.
Jennifer, thank you for that. I mean, even in microcultures, certain phrases come up that seem somehow so appropriate, germane to that culture that they stick. In Jennifer's case, inside every handsome young man, an old poop.
Every family has, you know, its own set of quotations. I knew an older couple that liked to say, each one would say, "When one of us dies, I'm going to Paris." And pretty soon, you know, all you had to do is begin with "when one of us dies" or say the word Paris. And, you know, it conjured up the whole quotation. And families are like that, you know, and a slightly neighborhoods can be like that. Generations can be like that. You know, my kids know all sorts of, you know, quotations that I haven't heard of, just the way they use all sorts of expressions I haven't heard of. And then there are the expressions that, you know, people of my age know and know not to use, like, you know, "too many chiefs," right?
Yeah.
No one would use that anymore,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas my kids don't even, thank God, don't even know the line, right? Mm-hmm. So that, in that case, you know, not using a certain quotation, which is why it doesn't get passed on, becomes the mark of a generation, as opposed to not using it, you know, not knowing it.
There's still gushing from our listeners here. George quotes Muddy Waters, "I ain't dying, but I'm not feeling so good." Rocco says, "Every child is an artist," he says here, quoting Picasso. "The problem is how to remain an artist once he grows up." Brenda, quoting Shakespeare, "Nothing's neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so." And Tree Room, quoting, he says, "Duke Ellington's last words, 'more kisses.'" Is that right? I don't know. It wasn't in my back room. Stephen in Newton, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Long time fan, first time caller.
Great. What have you got?
My father had a good friend of his, and when I was a little kid, he once said something, and I always latched onto it, was, he said, "There's two kinds of people in the world, the kind of people that try to divide the world into two kinds of people and the kind that don't."
Right.
A little Yogi Berra there.
Right,
your pops.
Right. That's great.
Got it. Yes. Here, Baz gives us from Moby Dick, "Who ain't a slave? Tell me that." Here's another from a listener. I'm not even sure. Well, F. Scott Fitzgerald from The Great Gatsby, "Reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope, and that may indeed be so." Gary, do you think that the internet age, the digital age, when they're so easily savable and shareable, has actually made us more attuned to quotations?
Yes, I think that the kind of reading that quotation anthologies encourage, which is not sequentially, but sort of when you pick up Bartlett's, you or the Yale Book of Quotations or the Oxford, you just skip from page to page. You kind of surf the book. And so, you know, the internet favors, you know, the sort of reading that an anthology does. You just go from place to place. You can follow a trail. And, you know, besides, it's easy to collect them. You just copy them and write them down. You don't even have to, you know, copy them out by hand. You can just do a cut and paste. You can make your own anthology easily. You can switch them.
And share them. Come to me. Aldous Huxley, come. Maybe this world is another planet's hell. Huxley. Mm. Or Rita Mae Brown, I finally figured out the only reason to be alive is to enjoy it. I can work with that one, Jack. What's still on your scratch pad there, Jack?
Well, these anti-epitaphs that that Gary has, Robert Benchley, for example, for an actress, quote, "She sleeps alone at last." I'd approve
last.
On that.
Oh, boy.
Well, the one for a waiter that is, "At last God caught his eye."
At last. Our Susie is heartened by Eleanor Roosevelt. "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent."
If only that were true.
If only that were true. John F. Kennedy, we could use this one these days. "Liberty without learning is always in peril. Learning without liberty is always in vain." Gary Saul Morrison, I'm so glad that you strode into these fields and made something of that vast harvest of quotations that is out there. It's been really great talking with you about it. People must always bring you their favorite quotations these days, Gary.
Oh, yes, and I hope they still do. I love it all the time, and I hope other people get to love it as much as I do.
They're everywhere. You remind us from Anna Karenina, Tolstoy. "Blessed are the peacemakers. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven," said Betsy, vaguely recollecting she had heard some similar saying from someone. Gary Saul Morrison's new book is The Words of Others, From Quotations to Culture. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Jack, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.